Philosophy 9, January 15th, 1954.
And you must try to answer this. It will bring us right into the heart of our problem of the family and of religion, of the art to live in two generations and in two sexes as representative of everything ever created and ever to be created. You remember, you are not surprised when I show you a spiral sheet in syphilis which is hanging together with the veins of the human body by these kind of whips or flagella. Spiral sheet means, as you know, being able to have such a hook by which they hook on. You yesterday asked me what the family represents. Well, it represents the totality of creation. Here it throws out its flagellum to the last moment of time. Here it throws it backwards. Here it throws it into the outer world in rejection, in defense, and here it throws it out in expanse, in conquest, in embrace, in comprehensiveness. And in, although people do not think this is funny when you put on such a scheme in humanity and history, they don't think anything when you put it on in bacteria or in little things. I don't see the difference. It is obvious that we, as human beings, behave in the universe exactly as any little bacterium does, trying to get a foothold in space and time, and to live eternally and at this moment represent everything ever created. That's why Mr. Freud can come and show that in any family all the primordial times of life of history are relived, because obviously all the ages of mankind must come again to the fore in any such family relation. So it's the Oedipus is just only one of them. I mean, kingship, royalty, priesthood, prophecy, all these things develop again in any one moment where you group in such a way together. This is so hard for you to understand, gentlemen, because parents today have abdicated all their spiritual tasks to schools. I mean, we have talked about this. Since parents have no authority and decline to have authority, and since the children are in the authority at home, I find time and again that a mother who feels that her child is naughty says, well, I send him to school, then he'll learn. Which means just that today it is so complicated to find the family relations because it is not represented by the carnal parents, you see, but by some teacher relationship, or by some doctor, or by some analyst, or by some psychologist. But don't think that they all together do not simply form your mother and your father. So you go to Mr. McKenna because you are short of parents. But they together form parenthood. And we here are expected to be even your wet nurse, because you don't seem to have enough. The other day a lady told me that after all at home children went on each other's nerves, so one wants to have the radio going and the other doesn't. So I sent him away to school, he said, of our older son. Well, I looked at her in amazement and said, so you think that instead of teaching this boy to behave at home with one sister or brother, you have to send him to such a stable of cows and bulls and oxen, of hundreds of them called Exeter or Andover, where they have to do this because of our discipline, say, because it's half military? But that's how today, for you, it is so difficult to find the family. But all what I do, gentlemen, is just to do what your father doesn't find time to and what he hasn't learned to do. To tell you about the past and its laws. And what your girl has to do, you to draw you into the future of the humanity. She doesn't, because she has nerves and she went to Smith's, so she has learned psychology. She's semi-destroyed. So, obviously, you will have to go to sensations and to burlesque shows and to Italy and to India and have to get airplanes. They're very expensive, you know, if your wife doesn't do the trick to turn you into the future, then you get it from artificial semination. But see that the problem is the same. You are drawn into these four directions and you are cursed if you do not fulfill them. And I have used the family as the integrated form of this all, but you poor people, you have to find it in 27 and a half psychology textbooks or something like that. But it is the same. And the psychologist demands from you to be right. With the same authority formerly a mother or father claimed, or grandfather, to be right, you see. The funny thing about psychologists is never that they say something. They say very little, I always feel. But they want to be bought. That is, they claim authority. In this sense, they simply line up against you as the older people. I mean, as all science does to the layman, who says, listen to me, I know. You cannot ever find how these scoundrels falsify the truth or what they omit. You just buy them. Now, since most people, however, think they have not such desire to represent the universe, to represent that strange creature of which we are told that God created men in the singular. You are, of course, very unhappy because you are little mice. You are men in the plural. As soon as a man knows that he represents the creative son of man, of God, on this earth at this moment, through his love of the past, his love of the future, his love of unanimity, and his love to exist, to resist evil, when he doesn't have the singular, this great feeling that he at this moment stands for the creative process itself and has the right therefore to decide what's dead and what's living, if he isn't there in the power of the word, which the Greeks in the New Testament call logos, in the power of defining what is dead and what is alive, that's logos. Will you take this down, gentlemen? Logos is the power to see what is dead and what is alive. What is who and what is what? That is logos. You never find it in modern textbooks. They have forgotten it. That begins, as you know, the Gospel of St. John says, in the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. Well, what's God's power? God's power is to decide what's dead and what's alive. He lets people die and lets them come to life again. He says of whole nations that they are, it's over with them. We now try to imitate him with Mr. Toynbee's 23 civilizations or the decline of the West of Spengler. You see, that's God does this all the time. Tell us what is gone, you see. Your old family is dying at this moment. Can't help it. Just the time is over. And if you listen to God, you know it. If you are, however, a dwarf, you go to Mr. McKenna and howl and say, I must have my mother's apron strings. Then you have not the logos, but then you have just superstition. Superstition is an attempt not to say what is dead and what is alive, you see, but to hang on to something that is already dead too long. Now, whenever we have this power, gentlemen, to decide what is dead and what is alive, we are the single men of whom God has created. We are all one. As soon as you say, oh, I don't know, I'm intimidated, I better not stick my neck out. You're just one little Lilliputian grain of dust. You are men in the plural. Now the story. A young French girl fell in love with a boy. She was 18, he was 24. They lived together as husband and wife, or as lovers, for 6 months. A story like Manon Lescaut, if you know. It's a great story of Manon, do you? Who knows Manon? Greatest love story in France. Yeah, much worth it. Well to know. And don't you even know the opera? Isn't it my hand that holds thy hand? Don't you know this wonderful aria? Yeah? Well, these two lived like Manon Lescaut and Herr Chevalier. And after 6 months, the girl said, or wrote, nothing can now excel, transcend this bliss. There is no life that can be better than this. I'm perfectly happy.
and she took her life and went out of this world.
And the boy, one of you, who was good enough to tell me this story, enjoined that I should go on from there and show you what happens if there is this queer feeling. This girl for 6 months was felt immortality. That is, through her, God, the divine life, breathed, so to speak. She was in perfect bliss. And then she said, since this cannot last, let's say goodbye. And she did. They're an American. But I think you have here a very clear case, gentlemen, between the usual pluralistic, worth good for nothing American pluralist, who says, don't quote me, and therefore is only running all the time and never is, man is a singular, because he has neither ties with the past, nor with the future, nor with the outer world, nor with himself. He's schizophrenic, as you know, and therefore he has to travel all the time, poor old manager, always on the go, so that he cannot even catch himself, you see, he has no time for that. This is something different. You see, here is this girl who fulfills completely the situation of the bride. The situation of the bride is not one who is courted, but who is before giving birth to a child, before becoming a mother, remember? All the beauty is before with her, whether she has, is lives with a man or just allows herself to be loved by a man. Don't draw the line between this virginity business, that's all nonsense. The decisive line for a woman is whether she gives birth to a child or not. You can be married for 10 years and still be a virgin. In any actual sense of the word. As you know, that's even in the Old Testament, the British young woman, Mary is called, you see. Before she has given birth, she is in this realm of beauty and of future and of promise and of transformation and of waiting to be called by her new name as this man's soul. So this girl was on this segment of the cross of reality. A beautiful soul, obviously. And living what? Living uniqueness. And from fear that this might become trite, you see, she gave this up because there is an old tradition in Judaism, in Hasidism, that the Baal Shem, the great wizard, should only, in his great love, should only sleep with the wife of his choice once. That's enough. And since this was perfect and he had waited for years and years and years, couldn't ever repeat it. You see, it could never become many. Now don't laugh at these things. From this French example and from this great Baal Shem legend, you may see how profound in men is the question of the unique. The doing something once only. I want to stress that this young woman is the opposite from the joiner and the rotarian and the 90,000 miles a year, 90,000 miles a year owner of a Chrysler or of a race sport car. She is here totally, but she has this one great fear of losing this singleness, you see, the singularity of her existence. Since you have to make your woman folks happy, you must understand that every woman wants to feel that to her husband she is somebody unique. If you lose this touch, you must do exactly like this French girl. Now, what is wrong then with this young woman? I want you to understand that the real man is between this young French woman and what you have as a run-of-the-mill student today. It is neither this nor the other. And you cannot simply say no to this case. I think these great cases like Romeo and Juliet, who after all never see the fulfillment of their love and whom we all need for our own fulfillment as a play, for our education. that these cases, gentlemen, are marginal cases, so that we are pushed back into life. That is, since the ordinary 2,800 students in Dartmouth try to be nobodies, very hard as they can, and since this girl, on the other hand, tries to be once forever and never again, our life is, so to speak, fenced in by these two extreme warnings. I think her life is no more tragic than the life of 2,000 of the students who come to this college out of 2,800. They never come to life, and she only comes to life once. There's not much difference to me in the way of missing life. What is wrong here, gentlemen? The mystery of life in a representative, crucial situation where we, even in our smallest family group, our smallest friendship, represent all of church, all of state, all of art, all of science, because Father means to represent everything that must be, gained for the sustenance of our wherewithal, so to speak, our livelihood. The mother represents any dignity, any value, ever created, so, and so on. When we live this way in some such connection, there is something unique every minute. This young woman was correct that she felt this love cannot last. It cannot. Marriage is not first love. The honeymoon does pass. It would be absolute artificial to say that it doesn't become weekday living. It does. Everything unique is finally routine. What we said about the act and the habit and the character, you cannot change this really. At the end, it's a run. But the strange thing about real life is, gentlemen, that something else equally unique, like having your first child, for example, takes, the place of uniqueness. We all have to keep what we have and to be reborn into something unique what we have not yet. The mystery, gentlemen, of life is, let me put it this way, that known qualities are newly created. Newly created, and then they must stay with us. This is very strange. The Baal Shem and this French heroine are both right in that they tell us and remind you that love is nothing if it doesn't strike you as unique. It isn't love. Then it's just mating. That you can do this in the cattle yard. If it isn't unique, it is not love. Love is the highest selection, and the Baal Shem only just said, the selection is not just between one man and one woman, it is even between the climactic high day of their lives of this one man and this one woman. And I think if you want to understand life, jot this down as an extreme case which is necessary for your understanding of living. This young woman and the Baal Shem are no perverts. They are no aberrations, gentlemen. They are tremendous object lessons of what you and I are surrounded by and are challenged into. If there is nothing unique in your life ever, you better were not born at all. Now what it is, whether it's the love of a woman or an heroic action when you jump into the Connecticut River to save a comrade or a little child, or what, whenever this unique event befalls you in life, or out in Korea or in an airplane, I don't know. Nobody knows. But that you should know that man is finally the man who does something unique, this you also know. Mr. Lindbergh remains for the rest of his life the man who flew to Paris, you see. He can't get out of this. That's his fate, it's his calamity, it's his prosperity, it's his happiness, it's his fulfillment. But after he had flown, he, you see, what was it called? The
of St. Louis.
The spirit of he was no longer the same man. He was the man of this one act. Now, you and I, gentlemen, don't forget it. We become the representatives of our best action. And never fall behind it. Many people may live this, their best act, without ever telling anybody what their best act is. But I assure you, you all know. You all know it. You see, what in your life really made you take your head off to yourself. Because you were surprised by yourself. You didn't know you could do that. So in life, gentlemen, and in the arts, in the arts especially, but here it is the case in life with this young French woman. These are the great signposts on your road through life. Respect them. Don't say of this young woman anything but heed her. Heed her. She does take this life, not just as an individual, but she does it because she finds that other people throw away such love. And in this disgust, she is not able to pray for anything but to singularize, to make unique this experience, you see, of the great merger of two young lovers. But as I said, in Mary's case, it is her son. She forgets Joseph, and everything is in the relation of mother and son, and the church worships there that her whole relation to the rest of the family is of a very doubtful character. We don't know, but I mean, obviously, the church tries to concentrate all the limelight on this singularity of Mary's relation to her son, which is a great injustice, I'm sure, to poor old Joseph.
I don't see how you can say that suicide was such great love. To me, suicide
was self-love. You have learned this by heart, Charles. That's a quotation. To you it isn't self-love, but to somebody who told you so. Because you have never been tempted by suicide, obviously. If you were, had been, certainly, you knew it was, despair is not self-love. I mean, have you never been despondent? This is ridiculous to say. This is a definition from the psychology textbook. I talked to a man about suicide who has bought a pistol and tried to shoot himself. Before I will not. Gentlemen, it is very important that we should have this very clear before us. This girl represents one moment's absolute value and claim. Now we discover, therefore, in our own life, this, which is, you see, it isn't self-love that this girl commits suicide. It is the love of the permission she has received to fulfill something to perfection. You see, she's willing. This is not her self-love at all. No, it is just, I mean, your definition is perfectly arbitrary. Here she is loved, and she knows this is an exaltation by which she has been deified, and she walks in Olympus, in the heavens, and she says, I don't care. Yes, and then you make such a face. You don't deserve to be told such a good story. I'm sorry. But you are all great little. You have no right to read Hamlet or to read Ophelia or to read Romeo and Juliet if you say suicide is self-love. Do you think Ophelia committed suicide from self-love? Fantastic.
I wonder if you could explain why this girl and her lover didn't culminate this in marriage.
Pardon?
Why didn't they... Were they married?
We have now. Pardon me, you see. The only thing
perhaps
I know in is that this man now is 28 and doesn't want to have anything to do with any woman.
Because you said they were lovers, and I thought they might be.
Well, obviously, you're quite right. It's very easy for you and me to detect the contradiction in this situation. Whenever a person speaks, and they did speak to each other, and whenever she says, this is perfectness, they are, of course, in the whole ocean of truth. That is,
you can only judge any one part of life by being inside the whole of it. So, because this young woman, you see, and here you come with the real problem of suicide, sir. It isn't self-love, you see, but it is your own judgment that you are your own judge, which is the opposite from self-love, you see. That you sit in judgment over yourself and don't judge lest you be judged. I mean, we are not judges of our own life. This is to be said against the suicide. But that doesn't help us in the sense that you, if and when into a person this false philosophy creeps that she says or he says, you see, I am the judge, you see, then he only imitates what every heretic today says, that he's a captain of his own soul, or all these people who send around. I just got from a medical student from Harvard who had offended me greatly. In order to make up for it, he thought, he sent me a paper in which he stated his religious beliefs. So I just read back and said, I'm not interested, I haven't asked you. There is no situation in which one makes such a conversion. All these people who send around today their statements about their personal convictions, to me just sick, very sick, shameless. There's no real situation. This girl and this man, this brings out this question, were unwilling and unable to create an other situation in which something else would have to be said and emphasized, like marriage. Perfection being here in this El Dorado, in these 6 months, and can't you see it? Can't you think that people really live away perhaps from their parents, away from professional urges, away from financial strain? Just they are able to go on a little journey, you see, for, let's say, for a week. It hasn't even to be 6 weeks, 6 months. This week they can live in perfect bliss. The reality, so to speak, can be forgotten. They have enough in their checkbook, so to speak, to pay all the bills that come in, and they are not bothered with the return of all these problems, the recurrence of their income. They have to take an examination, or they have to go home, or they have to pay a rent, or whatnot. I mean, for a week, every one of you can easily fathom such a paradisiac situation. It's a little more difficult for 6 months, but it is already something extremely long. Goethe has once said he has never been happy for more than 6 weeks in his whole life. And he was 82 and is considered one of the happiest of mortals. You and I, gentlemen, nobody is allowed to be happy for more than 6 weeks. If you live, if you do not just have this refrigerator temperature, which most of you have, of 35 degrees. But the anabiotic existence which you lead here in college, I mean, that's not living. It's a tin can existence. But any original life, gentlemen, is full of pain and full of bliss and full of happiness. And it's no longer more than 6 weeks. So this girl, from my point of view, had a right to say, this is unique, because we had no quarrel and we had no worry and we were outside the wear and tear of the routine of mere, you see, routine life for 6 months. What irks me with you, gentlemen, is that you do not know how rare any little perfection is in life. That to live 6 weeks or 6 months in perfectness is so rare that I have to stand in awe before this and say that's more than most people ever get. Because you have this fiction that you can be happy for 70 years, except for the dentist. You aren't happy, you aren't either unhappy nor happy, because you have no reason to live at all. You're just keeping breathing very suppressively, but that's not living. Anybody who takes on the world, gentlemen, has every reason for rejoicing and for mourning, for weeping and for laughing. But you only have tried to keep smiling. So you never are really exuberant, and so you never are very low. Now, you keep in the middle, most of you, not all. My story, of course, brings out that this girl felt she was given something that was beyond expectation, 6 months. Being passionate and being French, she knew a little bit about the instability of of your situation. Of la condition humaine, as they say in Paris now so gladly, of the human situation. So, what you can say of suicide and such after such fulfillment is two things. It remains representative of men's temptation to go to the limit of any one situation and say it is unique. And that's something positive. And you can say that's the heresy, the error, the dogmatic error of this person is that she wants to judge this, that she wants to label this herself as what it is worth and compare it with things not lived, with situations not experienced. Outside this uniqueness, she doesn't accept that God may send her other ways, you see, that also have to be trodden with the same devotion, the same originality, but it won't be the love to a man. You see that? I think she is right when she says, I won't have another lover, you see. Do you understand this? So I am very anxious, gentlemen, that you should not come and say this girl should have just gone on living. I say she should have gone on living, but she had the privilege and honor to let this stand as unique. This is, I think, the problem which you and I have to solve together, gentlemen. You think that nothing is unique. Or you are tempted, because here you see the bad outcome. Because she thinks it's unique, she takes her life. Now I say, if nothing is unique, then we should take our lives. Because then we are just insects, mosquitoes. What makes a man stand his ownness? What does Hamlet say about this? He says, as a unique person, I cannot commit suicide. That's the content of to be or not to be. That he will be judged as Hamlet. And he cannot say the delay of the law, you see, and what else is it, see? If I figure all the humiliations which I have to have to go through in my life, gentlemen, do you think that I sometimes really am disgusted with myself that I took it or stood it all? Why should one? Why should one have all that, these innumerable humiliations which an absolutely, disgusting mass, world of masses and mobs inflicts on you?
Wasn't Hamlet hesitant to commit suicide more of a fear of death rather than an expectation of a uplifting experience which would justify his life?
Well, quite indifferent to death, the physical death. He says because there's something after death. Now, what the people in 1600 call after that is the personal judgment that you may make your own fate so incomparable to anybody else's, which is uniqueness, you see. The judgment over the quick and the dead, which Christ is expected to deliver, and I believe this, is your own life singled out as not just anybody's life, you see, but a life that was under your own care or administration, you see. The uniqueness of your life. So by the word death, you just have postponed your understanding of the term. We mean by death that everybody dies his own death, you see. The millions of people born as a nature, I mean chickens and so on, but the way you consume this life entrusted to you, that is yours. You must, if you want to understand what people in other older generations meant by Hamlet's dialogue or by the Last Judgment, you must simply say it's what you have to answer this young woman. You must say, you are right, dear Margaret, or dear Elizabeth, or dear Charlotte, or whatever this girl's name was, you see. You are right that you crave to your life as unique. But the more unique it is, the more it is given and received, and the less it is done by yourself. That's Hamlet's experience. That's the greatness of the play. That he has to wait until everything is dissolved. What is the greatness of Hamlet? That he doesn't take the law into his own hands arbitrarily, you see. But that he allows all these scoundrels to reveal themselves, unveil themselves. So at the end is peace. When Hamlet goes, we are all reconciled to the world. If you go to Orestes, in the Greeks, you see, he murders, he kills his mother, and then for 3 generations there's a curse. And when Hamlet dies, the curse is dissolved. And that's his Christian message, and that his Christian inheritance. That's why Hamlet is a Christian tragedy. Not because they confess any Christianity, but because his life is lived in this double way, not as this young woman, as unique, you see? But under much greater difficulties from act to act, so that although he does love Ophelia, you see, but he has to play as a madman. He has to go on from one façon de vivre, one phase of life, into the next and into the next. Hamlet is still before you, gentlemen. You haven't solved the problem of Hamlet. Hamlet is your and my hero, because there is this double play in Hamlet, that it is something unique in every moment, in every one scene. Hamlet is up to a unique situation. And different from this young woman, he cannot take his life after he has fulfilled one. Why shouldn't he have taken his life after the first time? You are quite wrong when you say he fears death. That's not a word of truth. He's a very courageous man. He fights, he's a duel, he's aggressive. What he has to learn is not to be aggressive. This is all nonsense, what your textbooks say. Just read the text. He has not no cowardice whatsoever. He doesn't fear death, but he does fear that we all gentlemen carry in our hands as a tightrope walker a glass of water, the water of life, and you can spill that. And therefore, just as Jesus couldn't always stand up in the temple and provoke the high priest, but had to evade the issue and hadn't to rush to the cross, you see, but had to hide. So Hamlet is not allowed just to take a dagger and make a tremendous noise, as though he was a 6'6" football hero. Not at all. He is carrying the water of life, and he must not spill this. And so every one of us walks. And you don't know when you are allowed to drink this glass, cup or empty it. It takes a longer time in one case than the other. This young woman, you see, wanted to empty the cup herself, so to speak, and say this and throw it away, you see. This water of life is very easily spilled. The glass is easily broken in which we carry it, you see, with any impatience. Can you see the simile, I think, is quite adequate to show you that in Hamlet's case, if God says to me, you carry this glass of water, it's not a question of cowardice or courage anymore, you see. I do what's coming to me, you see, in every one moment. Somebody is attacking this glass, I'll kill the dragon, you slay the dragon, you see. If otherwise, on the other hand, I have no right to say that I'm not carrying this glass of water, you see, arbitrarily. I cannot. It's entrusted to me. So is your life, gentlemen. Your life is very frail and very delicate. That's why I do not like your attitude, either boasting with what you know and confessing giving your dogmatic statement on faith, and then always these dogmatic statements also of this doctor student who says, of course, there's nothing dogmatic about my faith, but it runs like this. Well, if this isn't dogmatic, I don't know what is. This is very, very much liked on this campus, that people, without being asked, write down their personal faith. Then they say, all against dogma. No, gentlemen. See, life is entrusted. This young woman knew that something was entrusted to her. But she thought it was limited, you see, to this one fulfillment, you see. And it is only the breaking off the long journey, you see, and saying it would have been as though Ophelia was the heroine of the play and not Hamlet, you see. Isn't that right? Now, gentlemen, the road, no, what is it?
Well, I was going to ask you, you say that a person who states his personal feeling about faith is dogmatic, but when isn't he dogmatic? I mean, if he gives it
is an answer to a question. When you have such a young woman, she wants to take her life, then you have to pray that God puts on your lips this word of faith, you see, which he will take as never been spoken before and never after, as a new word. It must be unique, you see. It must be so personal that he will carry on, you see. Because since he comes from a unique life and cannot stand the triteness of everyday life, if you just repeat something that you have thought out or read somewhere before, you see, as a general truth, she'll spit at you and she'll say, well, I feel that now I certainly have to take my life because this man is coming with commonplace comfort, consolation. But if you are able to say something that is as singular, as unsaid before, as Jesus says to the adulteress, you see, then the adulteress can be saved. What is the greatness of Jesus' words in the New Testament? That they had never been said before. That he says to the adulteress, anybody who wants to judge you, you see, may cast, who feels without fail, you remember, Paul, may cast the first stone. Well, this is just out of the ordinary, you see. So everybody is saved. The judges go home and the adulteress is acquitted without being acquitted. It's a new, unique situation. Now take this with this young woman. Certainly, she could only have been saved by somebody who had this deep faith in God's being God's creature and therefore not being your own judge, you see, but having this trust. But to express this to this young woman, the man would have had to be equal to her lover in uniqueness, so his word. Not as lover, but as teacher or as minister or as whatever, I mean, as comforter or as mother, but the word had to hit her. So that she, through this word, would have been able to enter a new relationship. The word spoken to her in this moment, you see, would have been like an outstretched hand inviting her to cross the bridge from her first paradise to the next paradise. Can you see that? That's why to speak, gentlemen, is an act of God in every case. You must know this. And you must know that sometimes a roommate just plays his part in a very dangerous situation with his roommate. That he, simply by being there and saying one word, he changes the whole aspect. I know that the boy here was saved from suicide just from by his roommate, who at the right moment just opened up. And could speak in this personal and direct manner. Not very learned, not very emphatic, but the boy felt it was he to whom this roommate turned his whole-hearted attention. That's all that's needed. That is beginning, or you see, of creating a new entity, a new dualism, a new group, you see, when this person, and in this case of this young woman, you see how difficult it was for anybody. Obviously, the ordinary run-of-the-mill priest couldn't do it. He just said, suicide is sin. He didn't understand that she wanted to live now in a second uniqueness, you see. So she had to find somebody who would say it to her as though nobody had ever said it to anybody. Can you see the difference? These quotations of dogma don't help anybody. Well, gentlemen, this young woman has rendered us a great service because she simply says there is no reason to be afraid to die. Now, all Americans have only one dogma. They don't want to die. And religion, gentlemen, comes into the picture when you and I become to know that life and death are not ultimate choices. That there is a good life and a good death. And there is a wicked life and there is a wicked death. There are four ways, gentlemen. Life can be minus and life can be plus, and death can be minus and death can be plus. If you say that every death, the death on the battlefield, the death in saving somebody else, the death on the cross of Jesus, is futile, you are this side of reality, of truth, because obviously you and I, even the man who says the crucifixion was futile, must die. And he then says, I want to judge my life this side of death, not including this what is coming to me. For my first day since I am born, this particle of dust which I am is just as much destined to die as it is to live. It is both. I found, in order to help you on, again, as against this young French woman, gentlemen, I found a very strange epitaph that on a tombstone in Italy, in Florence, that was put there in the year 1000. That's a long time ago. Or 1001, I mean, we don't know the year for sure, but about this 1001 probably. And it was for the ruler of Tuscany. Florence is the capital of Tuscany in Italy. As you know, the most beautiful, really the town, the most beautiful town in Italy. And? Now whom I brought is, I don't want to, this rest with me. Yeah. And there you read a whole poem, and perhaps you take this down, although it's Latin. But it's a very strange sentence. Well, everybody who knows English knows Latin, because English is only plural Latin, especially American English. Look to act in Terry's, you can understand this very easily. Qui semper vivere quaerit. Really, it's one of the scandals is that you are told that you speak English. You analyze what you speak Latin. There is 9/10 Latin in what an American boy speaks and what he calls, with some sentimentality, English. And if you were told that it is not Latin, you would all believe that you can read no Latin. And it would open up your whole vista here. Or it make it even easier. You know what quest is and query. So the word query here at the end means he queries, he seeks. He fluctuates on this earth. Who wants to live forever? Now you remember this girl was very steadfast and bold, and she was able to live on the top of life for 6 months. That's more than any one of us ordinary mortals can, because we are two everyday specimens and additions. On the other hand, gentlemen, all these pluralistic gentlemen who say, don't quote me, who live with the devil, are the people who can never live steadily. He fluctuates on this earth. Who queries to live forever? Fluctuat in terris, qui semper vivere querit. Semper, always, vivere, live, qui tu. He fluctuates, and terra you know from territory, of course, on earth. Now this too is was said of the ruler of Tuscany, that he was a man who had this steadfastness because it didn't matter. You expect from any general, from General Patton, that he attacks regardless whether he is shot dead or not, or that he can't be a general. Gentlemen, I expect of you the same. I hope that any one of you behaves like a young mother who bears a child, regardless whether she loses her life in the process or not. Obviously, you are no men if you do not come up to the same achievement of a young woman. You expect from your wife that she is willing to risk her life on the birth of your children. And you just accept that. You can only accept that if you know that there are a number of issues on which you will decide regardless of the outcome. May the chips fall where they may. A man who doesn't say this cannot be spoken to. He's just a prattler. He's a joiner. I have nothing to do with him because he doesn't know what the truth is. The truth is that the decision for which makes no difference regardless of whether I die in the process or not. If you have no such truth or no such value, gentlemen, you are below parity. You must understand, gentlemen, that the essence of any knowledge about real life depends on your power to treat life and death with equanimity. Otherwise, you are just biased. You are partisan. And if your life comes first, you see, you certainly are not apt to know the truth. Gentlemen, the knowledge of the truth depends on your indifference to life. And that's why so very few people know the truth and why the truth is hated. Gentlemen, the corollary of this sentence, that only he can know the truth who is indifferent to the outcome with regard to his own physical existence. Take any Quaker who risked his life in Massachusetts when he confessed that he was a Quaker. Take any Jew who under Hitler forfeited his existence when he said that he was a Jew. And then you say, what one word, one name you give to yourself can mean to your very existence. You can just go. When you see this, gentlemen, then you will understand that most people today must hate the truth. Because you are all told that there is no truth that is worth your precious life. Your precious life is more precious than any value of the community. Now, gentlemen, that is not true about the women anyway. And that's why men today is degraded in this country. That's why the women spit at you and all dominate you. The woman is superior to men in America at this moment. Because she is not, at least, has not completely struck against getting children. But where are your children, whom you beget as a danger of life? Now what compares to the begetting children, gentlemen, in your own existence? The sticking out of the truth. Of the next necessary thing to be said. You have to say this at the danger of life. This young man, lover, probably didn't want to risk his love. So he didn't strike out and change being a lover in time with his sweetheart and she took her life because he was wrapped up in this love affair. If he had really been a real man, he would have also undertaken, you see, to put their love in the light of the universal life. And he would have made her listen and also learn himself to speak. You see, no marriage can last if the two people do not believe in God. I have here a friend who married for love. It was a great love affair, Dartmouth boy, and great sacrifices, very great difficulties. She was in college in the second year, in a girls' college, and they married in a clandestine matter of marriage because these old spinsters at that girls' college, you see, wouldn't have allowed her being married, and so on. But they are divorced now. Why? Because the man became a communist, and he asked his wife to canvass the state of Vermont for Earl Browner. Well, if you invoke free love yourself, which is, after all, one of the tenets of communism, you see, and poke fun at the sacrament of marriage, you cannot blame the woman who, after 2 years, ran away with another Dartmouth student. He brought it on himself, because he did not speak outside the situation of making love, you see. He did not put first things first. Gentlemen, we speak in order to relate, the present moment to its proper place in space and time. And now this young man, can't blame him, he was young, did not do his full duty by this girl, you see, because he allowed her to remain wrapped in this one situation. But he didn't speak as a husband would have, you see, of this as one chapter in life eternal. But that is not the girl's fault. That's the husband's fault. Now, what do? You get engaged, then you go to the Episcopal Church, you have a wonderful mass celebrated in your favor, all stone and all just routine of old, nothing of your own doing. You just submit. And then you're silent about the gods like Confucius. Never say a word again about your religion. Allow the children to be sent to Sunday school. She goes to the women's club, maybe the religious fellowship. You go to the Rotarian. You go to your business friends. You go to the natural history museum or whatever interests you. And you never speak about the God and the power that allows every one chapter of life to be the singular realization at this moment of the eternal singular, then you wonder that she either runs away with somebody else, or that she has takes all her bed chamber secrets to her female friends, which is equally disgusting, or whatnot, or that she dominates her children because she wants to be at home somewhere. She has nothing to share with you. The only thing a woman has to receive from her husband is his believing God. All the rest is money. If you don't give her this, gentleman, she cannot love you. She may like you. She may like to go to bed with you, sensualize, but she cannot respect you. A woman must have, since she lives in the moment, she must have this one certainty that her husband is in connection with the higher powers. And that's his, your honor. You go into the whole of history, wherever there is Juno and Jupiter, or wherever there is Apollo and Artemis, the woman is holding on to what is created, the man is bringing in the next chapter, the movement. That's the relation between husband and wife. And in this, what do we have here? The whole noise and the whole erratic nervousness comes in from the barbar heavens. That is, they must represent the change, the civilization, the sensation, the great art. They hire Mr. Stokowski and Marion even. And the men, they pay the bill. That's all they do. But they do not represent faith. It is the men who must represent. You remember Mr. Simon. Why is he not a real man, you see? Because at that moment when he was unemployed, he had to represent real faith and not fiction to his wife, you see. So he built up a sham, you see, theater before her, instead of taking her into the depths of this change of decoration, you see, by which he would have, of course, emerged victoriously as the real man in the picture. Now, will you kindly see this? Most human beings, if they are not warned by time, live in this manner, gentlemen. They look back, you look back at your family, you have your bright ideas and your statement about the universe, and you have outside the resisting world, that's the frontier, or that is the world, or that is business, or these are the 60 million jobs, or whatever you call this outside world on which you are looking. Most of you live, you see, as idealists, as you call yourself, or as practical routineers, or as sons of your family, junior, or number three, or number four, Vanderbilt, or Rockefeller, and as juniors. That is, most of you gentlemen live in three dimensions. Mr. Einstein lives this way. All the naturalists, all the scientists, they have, there is a tradition, yes, you cannot admit this, he has after all tuxedos at times and a hat, I mean that's all background knowledge, background tradition. He's a doctor, he's a professor, he has his own ideas and he faces the universe. And this is life without death. Life without death. That is the general picture of a student in college. Most of you even think that this is only dualistic, subject and object. Put here your subjective ideas about the world, and here are the objective, is the objective world, and you live, but in fact you have also your mother, and she watches out that you don't give in too much to your ideas, or to the object of your adoration. Wants to be adored herself. That is, this is not a fun, gentlemen. It's very important that you should see. You live mentally, consciously, in a dual world. That is, you are subject and there are objects. But in fact, and I think you will admit it in analysis, you are here in Dartmouth, which is all background, which is all history, which is all here 150 years. And therefore, you really all live in the three aspects of life. This is past life, gentlemen. This is inner life. And this is external life. Very often it isn't very much alive. It's very often concrete and steel. But these are the three aspects of life. Now, gentlemen, as you well know, God has wanted us to die. And the future life or prophecy or anything important in life always must include death. What's the difference between a prediction and a prophet? That a prophet is not allowed to see the day of fulfillment, that his death and the death of Jerusalem, the destruction of Jerusalem, lies between him and the Messiah's coming. The important thing of the Old Testament's insight into real life is that they knew that God made it indispensable that a whole generation or many generations have to die in order to rejuvenate life on this earth. That the children, Moses was not allowed to see the promised land himself. He had to wait 40 years. And in order to allow the next generation to enter the promised land, he had to die. Gentlemen, you decline to admit that you only live because other people have died. That is, your rhythm of life is this way, here, from birth to death, and then somebody else is born and dies, and then somebody else is born and dies. This is your hectic life. Here, from birth to death. Now, gentlemen, I don't live that way. And the whole church is based on the assumption that we couldn't live if not somebody had died. That is, we wouldn't know the direction of our lives. The problem of the four founders, gentlemen, is this. That their death is already there when you wake up to live. And that's why that you know how to live. It isn't the question that you are interested in their philosophy. Neither Buddha, nor Lao Tzu, nor Jesus, nor Abraham have anything to do with consciousness or thought, or with dogma. The only thing is that they're there. Before you come into life, they have died. They have resigned. They have renounced. And by renouncing life, they have given your life meaning. You will now understand that this young woman has very much to do with us. Because as an object lesson, she is on the side of the founders of religion. It isn't my business and yours to judge her because she took her life. That's God's business. We have not to sit in judgment over this young woman, you see. But she's there. There she is, she's there. That is, we cannot, one such case is more important than 10,000 million people who have died in the process of life on this earth. She's more interesting. We have to speak of her. She deserves it. Because she has taken death into her hands. And that's a tremendous question mark for our life. In which direction should we channelize it? Where should it go? Not that we have to follow her example, you see, but it is there. And you cannot exclude it. Once you hear this story, gentlemen, it stays with you. And woe to you if you forgot it, forget it, and say that's just self. What do you say? Well, how do you call it, sir? Well, for heaven's sake, all the criminals, gentlemen, to protect you against going to Sing Sing. That's the meaning of crime, that you don't have to do it. And it isn't that. They are much more important for the good life, gentlemen, the people who do wrong, than the people who do good. Nobody follows the people who do good, but many people avoid the wrongdoers. Oh, you moralists, you ethicists, who look away from crime, where would we be without the criminals? But, gentlemen, you don't want to hear this. Fluctuat in terris qui semper vivere quaere. Since you want not to include this fruitful death, into your life thinking. You hate it. You become childish. Your main child is, that is, you go with every wind and every wave and every mood of every day, with the stock exchange and with the message to the nation. You depend on external broadcasts, on commentators who tell you what to think, and so on and so forth. Where is your own steadfastness? Where is your own faith? Where is your own knowledge of about the direction in which life, your life has to go? You don't have it. Because you fluctuate. You have made it a dogma. There has never been a more dogmatic generation, gentlemen, than the last two American generations. And every one of these Americans, when I talk to them, say they have no dogma. Always mistrust a person who says he has no dogma, because at least he has this dogma that he has not. If this isn't a dogma, I don't know. There is no person that has no dogma, that doesn't exist. You all have dogmas, but I think you have accidental dogmas and very stupid dogmas. I think I have very clever ones, because I am in agreement with the rest of humanity for the last 5,000 years. I have their dogma, and I think therefore I am in tune with the real men. And you have just self-made dogma. Why? Because my dogma includes death. I say that my first dogma is that God created us mortal. My second dogma is that those men who remember this fact of their mortality live differently from those who try to forget it. And I also say that the people who live with this direction projected into them by their knowledge of their finiteness, of their, it becomes free, and that they matter. That a man who doesn't fear death is the only decent fellow to live with in this world. And that all the joiners and all the people who are afraid to pay the penalty of death cannot neither know truth, nor beauty, nor love, nor sacrifice, nor hope, nor faith. They are just what we call secular. Cut off from the real tree of life. They have no connection with the meaning of our existence on this earth, because you only get this when you are utterly indifferent to the question, what's the outcome?
Why do you say the penalty is death?
Hmm?
Why do you say the penalty is death? Saying you fear the penalty is death.
Well, it's just a phrase. I mean, nobody likes to die, you see. Is that true?
Well,
we are reluctant. It's difficult.
Well, it sounds like you're
here. To tease you, throw a sign into your eyes. I mean, he is the exponent of your lack of meaning and direction. The terrible man. Because he didn't include life, death into your life. He didn't want to. So he had to live 94 years. As you know, Boas became a nuisance to himself and others in the end. We all can only pray that we live and die at the right time. You can live too long, you could die too early. I mean, nobody knows how this goes together. Very few people have this blissful existence, that their physical existence and their meaningful life absolutely coincide. Well, Jesus walked 1 year in perfect bliss on this earth. It's very short. And yet he redeemed the whole of mankind. Lao Tzu died and went away in middle age. So our examples are very contradictory. You can't tell. Abraham, who died as an old man, but Jesus was 33. He hadn't done anything before he was 30. At best, he lived 3 years in bliss. Now, this young woman certainly had only a partial experience. She wasn't the Messiah of the age, but 6 months a long period. I can only tell you, gentlemen, I once had here a group of young Dartmouth and Harvard students together. I have to mention it to you. And in this period, they knew they could do anything. They could conquer, like Cortes, we could have conquered Mexico. Only 200 people, we were 100. This is a fantastic story, as you know, that Cortes was able to conquer Mexico. It just can't be explained to the state. They had sublime powers. They were completely indifferent to the question of life or death. They just knew that this had to be done. And the interesting thing is, sir, that a few days ago, one of the participants, who still knows that this has been his real life there, and then said, you know, always when I come to think of this period, it seems to me that it has lasted many years, and yet it was only 3 months. And I can't understand it, he said, because it's so rich, it's so abundant what happened in those 3 months. We were, all our life was there. Everything came from it, everything centers around it. So, sir, what are 6 months? Everything. What are 6 months? Nothing. You can't judge it from the outside. If you ever have really lived a great life, gentlemen, you will know that it can have, if it has lasted 4 weeks, it can have been endless. It has the quality of infinity. I have to talk to you as to blind or colorblind, I'm sorry, but you have just to believe this, you see, that the high days of life do not underline your chronometry by your clockwork. That's not true. You can have in these 6 months everything, absolutely everything, and more than that. And as I said, if you think that to this day, every Sunday, millions of people really are refreshed by the wisdom enshrined in 3 years of the Lord's life on this earth, then you see that this life contains infinity. What are 3 years? It's ridiculous. As I said, there's only disputation, as you know, whether it's 1 year or 3 years of his walk on life. I'm inclined to think even that's 1 year. Well, let's assume it's 3 years. But after all, for 1950 years now, the people are fed by this, more or less, but certainly with an incredible variety of adaptation and application. How is this possible, gentlemen? Because it is just as possible as that in your little family, you represent the infinity of all life's processes. If you don't believe this, gentlemen, don't get married. Don't live at all. It isn't true that your life and another man's life and 2 billion people's life compose life. This is your materialistic fiction of all these idealists, all the liberals think, here's the men, there's the men, there's the woman, there's the child, there's the teacher, there's the professor, there's the farmer, and then all of them together live the good life. It's all utter nonsense. Nothing is true of this. But you live the whole of life, just as any leaf on a tree is the whole tree and has the shape of the whole tree. It's no use to say that these leaves compose the tree. The main point is that the leaf itself is the tree. So with the dates, sir, with the times, with the phasing, with the chronometric thing, be very careful. You will admit, you take a mosquito. How long does it live? 60 hours, 24 hours, I have no idea. Who do? Does anybody know the
fly lives today?
Well, you will admit that inside her life cycle, all the phases of your or my biography in some form appear. There appears birth, and there appears mating, and there appears exploration, and there appears metabolism and digestion and growth and death and decline, everything. Now, there was a very interesting Frenchman, de Nouilly. Has anybody heard of Mr. Nouilly? Biological time. Have you heard of this?
Continuity.
And he has a very much parallel from his biological idea. He says that there is biological time. That is, that a wound has its own life story, for example. Inside the 8 days of one small wound or the 4 weeks of a big wound, the same processes take place, one telescopic and one microscopic. And the same is true of you and my life and the life of humanity. Inside your life, all the features are there. This is called biological time because the times, the length of time, is in reference, you see, to the life cycle. Can you understand? Therefore, 5 years in my life and 1 hour in a mosquito's life may mean absolutely the same. And I suggest that in the life of the human race, of the humanity, 100 years mean exactly what 1 year means in your life.
You see.
Or even, free yourself from the assumption that organic life, organic time, has anything to do with what these physicists call time. They don't know what time is. It's just platitude. I mean, they call time an expanse in space. That something stays. This has nothing to do with you and my time comes from the rhythm of breathing, and all breathing is life-giving but also prepares death. The more you breathe, the more your lungs are used up, and finally your organism, simply by the act of living, dies, fulfilling itself. You see. The life itself brings on death. Therefore, the length of my lifetime and the length of the humanity's or civilization's lifetime are very much comparable once you see that inside your life you can have every experience, the whole of you, the human race, has. And this is with the human race too, gentlemen. One war, one crusade, one discovery of America, me. Concentrate into 1 year so much awareness, so much interest, and then you get 50 years of drabness and indifference and peace, you see, what people call peace. And it's perfectly legitimate to say that people in the World War did some thinking and now they don't. Now they only record the car sales and the department store sales. Is that thinking? I mean, if you see what is true, we read in our papers today, the community does no thinking at this moment, but they did a very hard thinking in 1943 and 42, in order to show you that life can be lived in such a way that 1 year means a lot, and in other contexts, 1 year means nothing. It means just dusk and dawn. We don't live in the same with the same intensity in every moment. So, gentlemen, these four men, Jesus, Abraham, Buddha, and Lao Tzu, can only strike you as relevant, as waiting to be answered, to be taken up. If you admit the strange situation in which you find them, you can only meet them. You can only meet them once you assume that their death and your life do both not matter. For a Christian, Christ is more alive, although he was died, than you. He is yourself. We are dead in our sins, and he is alive despite his crucifixion. If you can't believe this, don't say that you know what Christianity is. And of course, you don't know what Christianity is. All the children who in this unfortunate country today have to go to Sunday school are deprived of their privilege of knowing what Christianity is. Because Christianity begins with the on the other side of the grave. It begins only when a person knows that death is not more different from his own existence than life. If you can't even think this, and most Americans cannot even conceive this, don't go to church. It's ridiculous. I mean, the modern American Christianity is sham and fiction because it has abolished death. If Christianity is a belief this side of the grave, it has nothing to do with Christ. Absolutely nothing. Every word of the New Testament tells you this. But this is all a happy-go-lucky, keep smiling, you see, be a Boy Scout, etc. Do a good deed every day. Family, it's all this side of the grave. Well, that's not interesting, gentlemen. From this you cannot get direction. But you can get direction when you come to the conclusion that certain people, although they have died, are much more alive than you and I. We are really much deader. And that's why we still mention these four people, because they exert power. They are there. And we have some ambition to enter this strange realm in which the dead and the living, the quick and the dead, are under the same stream of life, or inside the same stream of life, eternal. And you have, perhaps today, you have grave doubts of whether any of these four people is able to reach you, because you have absolutely walled yourself in this side of death. And you are tin-canned. You have not made this contact with people to whom it made no difference whether they died or lived. If they only did at every moment that what had to be done. Because, gentlemen, the rhythm of real creation contains death as much as life. And we have just to die as often as we live. This young girl had to die to her love. Only she, so to speak, cast out the baby with the bath, you see. If she had just said, the time for the great love is over, she would have been right. Only she consumed everything else with it. But that's a minor thing. She strikes me as somebody from whom you can learn that we must die in order to come to life. And I'm sure that this doesn't meet with your approval. And therefore, gentlemen, modern man has no religion. It is quite true that what Nietzsche said, that God is dead. But the reason is very profound, you see. God always is dead in a society which only wants to live. If you have all the life, then God gets all the death. This is much more than my private saying. If you do not see that at this moment there is not America, but there are certain elements on the scene which we must bury and we must weed out in ourselves and in this civilization, which have to be declared to be dead, 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 and others which we have to cry into life. If you do not see that at this very moment, you and my decision is to say what is alive and what is dead, you see. Unless you do this, death is meaningless. But you and I are executioners. We are grave diggers. This grave digger in Hamlet, you see, is a very profound person. We have to dig the grave of the things dead. And this we can only know when we form a judgment what and how much of us deserves to be executed, to be buried, to be left aside, to be left behind. We have a relation to death which is very practical. It has nothing to do with your physical death, gentlemen. But for example, take your alumni belongings, take your family sentimentality, take your descent as an illegitimate child from a Scotch king, as so many Americans boast to. I don't know how many whores this Scotch king seems to have made pregnant. But they're normal, you know, there's a whole association here of people of royal descent in this country. But when you look into the membership, they all claim to be illegitimate descendants of some Bruce or some James or some other murderer. And the very bloody history, the Scotch history, you know. And but what do we bury out of this ancestry? Of what do we deny, so to speak, the place in our evaluation? Well, here we have the topic of the last week. We have a class on next Friday. Yes. Take this as the topic, gentlemen. How far are we alive and how far are these four men alive? If you really can say that they are still there, then you suddenly enter this tremendous, strange realm inside which death and life are minor questions, as we understand life and death, physical and physical life. Thank you.